For decades, a mystery has haunted Tamworth.
Mark Anthony Haynes' body was discovered on an isolated stretch of train tracks.
No one talked about him. He was just another little black fella.
An ABC True Crime podcast was followed by a fresh inquest.
Someone's just holding their breath.
If he didn't do it directly, he knows what happened.
With the truth closer than ever, hear the whole story now. Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wandjeri Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, Australia records the highest number of Indigenous deaths in custody in four decades.
Well, it's no surprise. It's an absolute national disgrace.
That is First Nations Independent Senator Lydia Thorpe. Today you'll hear what she has to say about these devastating figures and her calls for governments to implement the recommendations from a royal commission handed down nearly 35 years ago. Then we'll cross over to the United States because Washington has seized an oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela. We'll bring you the latest on that developing story. And Donald Trump's rhetoric isn't just ramping up in South America. He's also called European leaders weak, particularly when it comes to immigration. You'll hear from the Vice President of the European Parliament.
It's a whole new school of thought in which he uses very simple verbs, challenging words and so on.
That European perspective is coming up. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, thank you for joining us for another episode of The Breakfast Wrap. And we're going to start with these really sobering figures released overnight, showing that Australia has recorded the highest number of Indigenous deaths in custody since 1979. I'll take you through the figures, and then we'll go beyond the numbers with Senator Lydia Thorpe. Now, this data comes from the Australian Institute of Criminology, and it counts 113 people who've died in police or prison custody in the last financial year. It says 33 of them were First Nations people. The state with the highest Indigenous death toll in custody is New South Wales, but nationally, First Nations people make up 29% of all deaths in custody. They make up just less than 4% of the whole Australian population. Lydia Thorpe is a Gunai, Gunditjmara and Jawurung woman and an independent senator for Victoria. She came on this morning and she gave Melissa Clark her reaction to the figures.
Well, it's no surprise. It's an absolute national disgrace. And to have 339 recommendations from the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody in 1991 not implemented, we're going to continue to see Aboriginal deaths in custody. So the Albanese government needs to take this on board as a priority, and we need to see action. We need to stop seeing these deaths occurring, and the recommendations will end these deaths if they are implemented.
The Federal Attorney General Michelle Rowland told the ABC that the Albanese government is deeply concerned about the data, and she said that the disproportionate representation of First Nations people in prisons is unacceptable, and that's the key driver of over-representation of First Nations deaths in custody. Do you think that's right to attribute deaths in custody as a result of over-representation in the prison system?
Look, there's a number of reasons why Aboriginal people are dying in custody. Racist police is certainly a contributing factor, and the fact that states and territories are only going tougher on crime, which only exacerbates the problem. We know that hanging points is a massive problem, and that is one of the 339 recommendations that have not been implemented. We know that hanging points, particularly there's one in Queensland that's been used 20 times. I've raised this with the Attorney General herself. I've raised a number of examples of why there needs to be oversight, national oversight of the recommendations so that we can end these deaths. So there are a number of contributing factors.
I seem to recall in the past when this has come up that the federal government has said, look, ultimately things like hanging points have to be dealt with by state and territory governments. It's in their jurisdiction. The federal government doesn't have jurisdiction over prisons in state and territory governments. Is it incumbent upon state and territory governments here when it comes to implementing that Royal Commission recommendation?
The federal government have got away with that very poor excuse for three decades. That is a lie, because the federal government have constitutional power to set national minimum standards. Now, the Minister for Indigenous Australians has indicated that she may penalise states and territories through funding arrangements if they don't meet closing the gap targets. Well, allowing or killing our people in custody should be a trigger to stop funding these states and territories. And if we look at the Northern Territory, closing the gap money went to the Northern Territory Police to the tune of over $200 million. Now, that $200 million could have been better spent in communities to self-determine our own solutions. So for the feds to handball this to states and territories is a cop-out, and it's been proven that the feds have constitutional power to override states and territories and set minimum standards, like removing hanging points.
The Northern Territory government has blocked United Nations human rights investigators from visiting prisons and watch houses and from speaking to personnel in their prisons. What do you make of that move by the NT government?
Well, obviously they've got something to hide. Why would you not allow the United Nations to come in and look at the state of affairs for people incarcerated in the Northern Territory? We know that those particularly youth detention centres and the prisons are all overcrowded. We know that there is no medical supports for people incarcerated. I've heard terrible stories of prison guards holding back asthma pumps to children who are having asthma attacks. So there is complete human rights violations happening in the Northern Territory and in other jurisdictions. So the Northern Territory government are perpetrating this violence and want it hidden from the world.
And that is Independent Senator for Victoria, Lydia Thorpe. She is a Gunai Gundutjmara and Jabiru Victorian woman. Well, turning overseas, and earlier this morning, around the middle of the show, we got news from the other side of the world that the US had seized an oil tanker off the Venezuelan coast.
As you probably know, we've just seized a tanker on the coast of Venezuela, large tanker, very large. Largest one ever seized, actually.
Now, the administration says it was being used to transport sanctioned oil from Venezuela and Iran. That is important, because the US has been waging a campaign of violence against Venezuela. It's been targeting boats coming from Venezuela with deadly strikes, killing those on board in international waters. Now, Washington says that those boats were carrying drugs to the United States. It's deemed the crew narco-terrorists, and it's justifying its violence as self-defense. Now, it's offered little evidence of said drugs. And legal experts, as well as Democrats and some Republicans, have raised questions around international law, maritime norms, the laws that govern war, and also US constitutional law, whether the president even has the power to authorize these strikes without the approval of Congress. On top of that, Mr. Trump has authorized the CIA to carry out covert activity in Venezuela, and he's even launched the largest naval buildup in the Caribbean Sea in decades. So this just adds to all of that. Now, in Venezuela, the president, Nicolas Maduro, not loved by the Trump administration, has called for peace, not a crazy war.
To American citizens who are against the war, I respond with a very famous song.
Don't worry, be happy.
As one sings for peace, the other beating the drums of war. As soon as this news first broke in the US, we dialed up retired US Air Force Colonel and defence commentator Cedric Layton, and he explained the situation.
So the U.S. Coast Guard was engaged in an operation that basically interdicted this vessel, in other words, captured it. And so the way the president has described it, President Trump described it, it is the largest ever. We'll see, what the real facts are relating to this. We don't know exactly yet what the name of the tanker was or exactly where it was seized, except we do know that it was seized in international waters off the Venezuelan coast. So that's going to potentially be a very large change in the way the U.S. is conducting these operations. It seems that this may be the start of an economic effort to go after the Venezuelan regime, which of course is a very different mission from a counter-drug mission.
I was going to say, do we know what the rationale is? Is it part of the drug tackling efforts? Is it a hit on Venezuela? Or what the Trump administration plans to do with this vessel now that it's been seized?
Yeah, so that's the one thing that he did say about that last part, Mel, was the fact that the U.S. would keep the vessel. That depends on the situation. As if it's a war booty type occurrence, and we're not at war, so this begs a few questions in that regard as well. But basically, what we're looking at here is a vessel that has nothing to do with the drug trade. Normally, now there have been occasions where drugs have been found on oil tankers, but the Venezuelans generally try to keep drug trafficking separate from the oil traffic, because the oil is actually their largest export. They have a very large customer base in China. China is their basic export customer, their number one export customer. And then they do, of course, also sell oil to the United States, among other countries. But this will definitely put an economic aspect to this. And what that means is that this counter-drug effort has morphed into what could be an economic effort and potentially even an effort at regime change. We were always suspicious of that we would be getting into a regime change type situation here, but this definitely points more in that direction as opposed to a counter-drug mission.
Certainly, there's plenty of observers who believe President Trump does want to depose Nicolas Maduro. So whether that's the intention or not, what would be the message that President Maduro would be receiving from this action?
Well, basically, that everything that he's doing in terms of trying to export their main product, oil, to other countries is at risk. And if the main exports are at risk, in essence, what this amounts to is a slow strangulation, a potential strangulation of the Venezuelan economy. That would then in turn put pressure on the Venezuelan government and potentially, in addition to the economic situation being worsened, which is already quite bad in Venezuela, then you would see political implications and political efforts being made then to change the regime. So that's basically what we're looking at here. And I think the way in which this has taken place, it's different from normal military operations, because the Coast Guard is actually a law enforcement agency in peacetime. And that is, this is a classic law enforcement type operation. The vessel itself is probably a sanctioned vessel in the sense that the oil flow out of Venezuela is also subject to international sanctions. So in that sense, it was a legal effort to limit Venezuelan exports, but it also has the implication of really tightening the noose on Venezuela economically.
As much as it might be an economic noose, could it be a trigger for a broader confrontation, having a maritime confrontation like this?
It's possible. Venezuela's navy is not very robust. It's certainly nowhere near the U.S. Navy or even the Australian Navy. But it is, clearly a signal that they're. The tensions have increased, and the fact of the matter really is that with these kinds of operations and announcing it at this level, at the presidential level, it really puts the onus on the Venezuelans to reach some kind of agreement with the U.S., and that could mean an effort to get Maduro out of the country, or it could mean some other kind of accommodation. But we don't know what the nature of that accommodation would be at this point.
And you were just listening to retired US Air Force Colonel and defence commentator Cedric Layton speaking with Melissa Clark on Radio National Breakfast. Well, let's stay with the United States because European leaders have hit back at comments from Donald Trump after he labelled them weak. He said European civilization was being eroded by immigration. It comes as European nations were still reeling from the release last week of a new US national security strategy. The White House claimed Europe was facing civilizational erasure. Nicu Ștefănuța is a Romanian politician and a vice president of the European Parliament. He came on with Mel this morning.
In February, President Trump said the EU was formed to screw the United States. So he's long made antagonistic comments about the EU. With that in mind, what do you make of his latest comments?
If you think about it, this is a way of communicating for President Trump. It's a whole new school of thought in which he uses very, very simple verbs, very challenging words and so on. I'm not sure if the American establishment thinks that, but the European Union was formed to guarantee peace. And we've been doing that for the past 80 years. We've been doing that to ensure prosperity. We've been doing that to show the world that unity can actually work. And we have not been a source of war for the past 80 years. We have been a source of peace, a source of value, a source of trade. So this is what the European Union is.
So do you think Donald Trump is just using language like this to send a message to his own voters domestically? Or do you think there's a disconnect between what Donald Trump says and what other Americans, including Americans in powerful positions, how they perceive Europe?
I don't dare to analyze his motives, but what I can tell you is that the European perception among regular Americans, as well as regular Australians and other Western nations, is positive, as it should be, as is our perception of regular Americans, regular Australians. So I'm not sure. I think it's maybe part of a negotiation tactic that's been widely documented.
Some European leaders have accused President Trump of interfering with their domestic politics by signalling that he could endorse right-wing political candidates in some countries. Do you think that's something he would follow up?
To be honest, I've seen that more from people who have associated with the administration rather than the administration. I come from Romania, and Romania has had very difficult, painful elections that were cancelled due to foreign interference and so on. And there, I have not seen the State Department or even the administration say anything else than congratulations to the person who emerged as the winner. So I think we are also subject to a bit of sensationalism that people like to personalize politics, to put it all in Trump's hands or to put it all in somebody's hands. But to be honest, I've seen more Elon Musk doing that kind of thing than President Trump or the administration.
Nicu Ștefănuța is a Romanian politician and a vice president of the European Parliament. Feels like every international story we touch at the moment features the name of the US president. You'll remember when fighting first broke out between Thailand and Cambodia back in July. Nearly 50 people died as a result of skirmishes that centre around a centuries-old border dispute. It's a dispute that still is the cause of nationalism and posturing and, today, violent confrontation. Well, back then, the US helped broker a ceasefire, something that Donald Trump claimed credit for. Now, attention is back on the US president because fighting has broken out again. There's been days of violence between Thailand and Cambodia. Hundreds of thousands of civilians are displaced, and a number of people have already been killed. Cambodia says that it wants talks, while Thailand insists the conditions aren't right for negotiations. Canberra politics professor Carl Thayer explained why the fighting has restarted.
In brief, in July, they agreed to a ceasefire. October, Donald Trump presided over a wonderful declaration. But in November, a Thai soldier was injured in a mine explosion, and Thailand unilaterally withdrew from any obligations under that. So it left the status quo of two militaries that just don't trust each other, and a border 800 kilometers long that's not defined.
Both sides are blaming each other for hitting civilian areas. In your view, is it clear who is driving the latest escalation?
Well, I'd start off by saying I don't think it was premeditated, but the militaries on both sides have been given almost carte blanche by their political leaders for domestic reasons. Cambodia just doesn't like Thailand historically, and the Thais are really upset about this particular border. So I think it's military officers on both sides, primed and ready. They see something that's provocative, they respond. And they've responded. We've seen drones, multiple rockets, airstrikes. So it's escalated.
Hundreds of thousands of people on both sides of the border have been fleeing the area. Do we have a sense of how serious the humanitarian impact is on the ground?
Absolutely. It's worse than the July fighting where some 48 people were killed. That number hasn't happened, but the estimates are about 400,000 Thais in seven provinces and 100,000 Cambodians in three provinces have been resettled and displaced. And the number of civilian casualties is rising, and it depends every time you look at the reports coming in. But at least nine Cambodians are killed and several Thais.
Carl, going back to the ceasefire that was brokered by Donald Trump, do you think there's a chance it can be revived?
It's a pregnant moment in that Malaysia's ASEAN chair, and it expires this month, and the Philippines takes over. And reports that Prime Minister Anwar was going to convene a meeting last night, 10 p.m. our time, but not much seems to have happened. Donald Trump at a rally in the United States said he's going to solve it. He's going to make one phone call. So we're waiting for that to happen. And yes, I do believe Trump will step in and threaten both sides, either with tariffs or some other punitive steps, because it's too much at stake for him.
Is that what it would take to get a resolution? Because what do we know about the appetite from Cambodia and Thailand to sit down and talk it through to a resolution?
Both sides want to portray themselves as the victims. And Cambodia does not want to antagonize the Trump administration because of its textile and other support. But the Thai prime minister has a very shaky coalition of many parties, is facing elections in January. And the Thai king has just come back from a visit to China, and he said he's more concerned about Thai sovereignty than he is about Trump tariffs. Both sides need a face-saving device, and that's why U.S. intervention or other intervention would be just wonderful. And if the U.S. can work with the Philippines come January, an ally, that could provide the avenue. What's needed and what failed from the last time was an agreement to put an ASEAN observer team, professional military, all along the border. So you'd have independent observers who could call the shots and say, aha, the first shot came from over there. Not, you know, and both sides couldn't posture anymore. All the previous flare-ups have resulted in not a settlement. It's demining of a border and demarcation of a border. That's the long-term goal.
And that is Canberra politics professor Carl Thayer explaining the details with this conflict. Well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Breakfast Wrap. Across this week, every interview has been presented by Melissa Clark, produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team, and The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Josie Asher. I'm Luke Sidham Dunton, and tomorrow we will have a very special episode of The Breakfast Wrap, peering back through the year that was 2025. So, 11:30 on Radio National or slightly earlier on the ABC Listen app. Don't miss it. See you tomorrow.